Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our day if we keep on the sunny side of life.
So Simon Jones, what's your next prediction?
My next prediction is that in 2019, there will be more deals that are funded via a mix of direct ECA lending, covered bond programs within banks, official liquidity schemes from the likes of SEK, FEC, KfW, etc., insurance and pension funds. So probably the biggest shift, well, the shift has been increasing for over time. It's been a growing event over 20 years. But I think by the end of the year, there will be more transactions funded in an alternative way rather than traditionally from banks' own treasuries. Partly because this is an ongoing process within banks trying to be more efficient internally in terms of use of their own liquidity, but also I think the regulation issues are really going to start to bite. Banks, I think there's a demonstrable change in attitude between 2017, 18 and now 19 as to what the new regulations really mean internally.
Well, before we discuss that, I think if we kind of could potentially pair that up with Simon Sayre, you have a prediction on the regulatory front. Perhaps you want to go into that and then we can have a discussion, because I think both sort of issues
will
overlap with each other slightly.
Yeah, this was going to be my third one, but happy to bring it forward now. So I predicted for 2018 that there wouldn't be a clear resolution of the inclusion or exclusion of export finance ECA covered assets in the leverage ratio. My prediction for 2019 is that that will be resolved, and probably in the first half of this year. Because we see a convergence of opinion now across the European Commission, the European Council and the European Parliament that really a quite large part of the ECA-covered asset class will be excluded from the leverage ratio calculation. And that's something that I think going back 4 or 5 years, we all found quite difficult to contemplate, because let's just remember what we're talking about when we talk about ECA-covered debt. This is sovereign, effectively quasi-sovereign debt, and banks are sitting on huge swathes of sovereign debt, particularly in Europe. And the idea of excluding part of that from the leverage ratio, which was intended to limit the size of banks' balance sheet and constrain their ability just to balloon the balance sheet over and above their capital base, if you exclude ECA-covered debt from that, you're eroding what was a very, very firm position, not just of the EU regulator, but the US and the Asian regulators as well. It looks like it will be very, very clearly restricted to just the ECA-covered assets. So it's not extending to any other part of the sovereign debt asset class that I'm aware of, certainly. But the EU, at least, will take it out. And this will mean that when banks look at how much capital they need to allocate to their export finance book, it's going to go down really quite dramatically. So if this gets decided in 2019, typically EU law takes a couple of years to be passed. We could be looking at a new law and this new regulation being viable or active from about 2021. But remember, banks start preparing themselves for changing regulations really quite early. And these are long-dated assets we're talking about too. So it has the potential to, again, support the amount of liquidity allocated to the export finance asset class within financial institutions, because they will not have to set capital, leverage ratio capital, against their export finance book, or at least a part of their export finance book. And it's going to be the, if I can call it, the better rated part of that export finance book. There are certain qualifications. Those three decision makers will need to reach a consensus. But for a bank like us, it could be well over half of my book suddenly sits outside the leverage ratio. which is quite ironic because, as I've said on other occasions, I've spent the last 5 years preparing for an environment where we have to address leverage ratio. We didn't think we'd get ourselves to this position, but we have. And there's been a lot of support from exporters, from national export finance entities connected to export credit agencies. Frankly, it's not really the voice of the banks that have been heard here. It's more the supporting voice that's been coming from the industry. So very, very interesting development. It's going to take place this year.
Well, that sounds like a bit of yeah, I wouldn't call it insider information, but it sounds like you're well briefed at the very least. The reason I sort of put those two predictions together is I wonder if sort of part of what you say, Simon Jones, about sort of the regulatory pressure on banks and certainly on the commercial debt element of ECA-backed transactions, that dropping down, does this counter that somewhat? And if so, I suppose, does it happen straight away or in the future?
Yeah, I think it clearly will have at least a modest counterbalance to what I've just said. But
modest?
I think because what I'm talking about is actually a train that started moving some time ago.
I agree.
And is growing and growing and growing and growing. And I think whether the leverage ratio issue happens or not, I think that train is not going to stop. I think the train will carry on moving. And I think for banks to contemplate lending long-term loans with sovereign guarantees is not something that was built for banks to do, fundamentally, in my view. And I think, I'm not saying ECA lending is going to go out the door. At the moment, we have, I don't know, 150, 160 billion, whatever, of ECA lending. And there will be banks coming in of ECA, coming into ECA lending and banks going out of ECA lending. It seems to be pretty dynamic. But the infrastructure for funding export credit loans in alternative ways, rather than the bank just ringing up their treasury and saying, can I have 20-year dollars, please, it's changing. It's moved. Yes. So the infrastructure has been put in place by ECAs. It's been put in place by, you know, insurance companies and pension funds have been buying into ECA transactions for the last 20 years. The instance of that, I think, is growing, and banks are still doing it. Banks don't shout about this an awful lot, but behind the scenes, they're actually doing it. Their secondary, their existing portfolios are being traded out into insurance companies and pension funds. And the amount of liquidity coming directly from the ECAs is increasing, and I think there is a role for that, particularly for the longer-dated stuff. There are ECAs today who are contemplating, this is fact, contemplating, ECAs who haven't had a direct lending program are contemplating their own issuances to develop and have the capability to lend direct. Now, there is a bit of a currency issue here as well. I mean, ECA business, as we've discussed, used to be 90% dollars and 10% euros or 9% euros and 1% other. It's now moving to 60-40-ish or something. And there are economic reasons why that is happening. It's not because, I don't think, well, I guess the euro has sort of gained strength as a currency since its inception in 99. I think it's the economic driver at the moment that's driving business into the eurozone. And so you've actually got two separate businesses in banks, particularly in the European banks, where they have their dollar business and how they will treat their dollar business, and their euro business and how they will treat their euro business. So I think it's more complicated than saying just because the leverage ratio is going to be okay, every bank's going to stop funding themselves outside and they're going to sort of put everything on balance sheet. Yeah, for the euro business, they may continue to do that. But for dollars, it's a matter of liquidity. Where does a Japanese or a European bank that doesn't have a strong deposit base in the US get its US dollars?
I completely agree with you, and notwithstanding the fact that the regulation is changing and it might make it easier for banks to lend, these seeds have been sown quite some years ago, haven't they? And that we're starting to bear the fruit, and the asset class is becoming much more widely known just outside pure bank lenders, but across insurance firms, pension companies, and so on. When you started talking about currency, interestingly, I thought you were going to talk about local currencies because, you know, if there's an area that really is important for capital markets, it's in local currencies, you know, be it Rand or the Brazilian Real or where. And there was a deal done last year, a very interesting deal, actually, in Brazil, where money was raised against a local currency, Brazilian Real debenture, for an infrastructure bond.
And it was the size of that deal that actually...
Serve-backed, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was the size of that deal that made the headlines more than anything else, because local currency deals have happened in South Africa, in Mexico, and Russia, but they tended to be, you know, $5, $10, $15, $20 million worth. This was $600 million worth.
So I think if you think about local currency, which we've been talking about for many years, and it hasn't become a significant part of the market, but it looks destined to grow, that lends itself to external, non-bank balance sheet funded instruments.
It's interesting you say that, because from other, not this industry, but other industries that we work with, we're increasingly being asked, can you give us a better way of seeing currency fluctuation coming? Because increasingly, we're being asked to deal in local currencies, or we're worried about currency repatriation, and we have been burned too many times.
Yeah.
You know, we don't see it coming enough in advance to mitigate against it appropriately.
Mm. Going back to these two guys, their predictions, I think that both of them can't be right. So, for example, if...
A few burgers coming around here.
Yeah. So if Simon Sayer's prediction comes true, the knock-on impact of that isn't, as you said, I think earlier, liquidity. Because I think there's always plenty of liquidity in the market for assets. I haven't seen an ECA deal fail. The issue is about pricing. So if you look historically... to the ECA asset class, when it was deemed to be zero-weighted and there was no discussion about leverage ratio, you had LIBOR flat or even sometimes sub-LIBOR funding for ECA assets. Now, where that happens, the banks are clearly doing this for the relationship reasons and the ancillary business associated with that particular transaction, which means, I'm now looking to Simon Jones, the banks will still become very heavy players in this asset class, because that relationship wider issue for fixed income investors is doesn't mean anything to them. So what I'm saying is, at the end of the day, if it becomes zero-weighted, no impact on leverage, pricing will, in my opinion, drop significantly, which actually means, when I'm turning to Simon Jones, fixed income investors are not going to be interested in purchasing these type of assets.
But I'm not talking about fixed income investors per se. I'm talking about a
non-bank,
huge fragmented array of liquidity providers. Non-bank insurance companies, pension funds, fixed income investors are part of that.
Okay.
I agree. But yeah, there's a bigger play. There's the export credit agencies issuing their own bonds either directly or going to another sister institution to issue bonds. And that's a very efficient form of funding compared to banks. Talk about internal cover bond programs, FANBRIEF, those types of things. They will just carry on increasing. The investors, the insurance companies, the pension funds will sort of just pick up when the market dictates they can pick up. And pricing fluctuates. If you look at where pricing has been since the crisis, from your bottom point of minus 5.
180?
To probably 225 and back down again and all over the place. And that's just in 10 years. It's been hugely volatile.
And I'm not going to talk about... And prior to that, if I'm sorry to interrupt you, prior to the financial crisis, when at that point in time you were in this scenario of no impact on leverage, no requirement for match funding. What was the volatility in price for the previous 20 years on export credit financing prior to the financial crisis?
Reducing.
Yeah.
Not volatile, but
a
big range.
Gradual reduction.
Look, yeah. Reduction. I'm not going to talk about pricing, okay, the impact of regulation on pricing. But in terms of the liquidity, it should certainly be supportive of more liquidity. But to be very, very clear, our two points are not mutually exclusive. You know, you can still have a favorable regulatory environment, which is encourages banks to stay in the export finance business, but you can also at the same time have a richer source of funding coming from capital markets investors, direct lenders, and all the other new entrants to the market over the last 10 years. I don't think, Gabby, they're two mutually exclusive things.
I just have one final question relating to your prediction, Simon Sayre. Just obviously, you're specifically talking about EU regulation. I'm just wondering if you see any impact either of that in the US or for the US banks, for the Japanese banks, or also even for some of the British banks with the Brexit scenario, or is that all too early to say?
Yeah, so for sure they'll be watching the developments. The US, it's a bit of a moot point at the moment given the status of US Exim. The Asian banks aren't constantly asked about leverage ratio and impact. I think you're absolutely right to ask about the UK banks, though, because there are certainly some big question marks over how post-Brexit non-UK ECAs will be viewed from a balance sheet and regulatory capital consumption perspective for the UK banks. So to be determined.
And to a, yeah. Yeah. Okay, great. Gabby, on to your next prediction, please.
My final prediction is that Africa will continue to grow as the highest growth market for ECA, i.e. it's not going to be the biggest in absolute terms, but its growth in terms of usage of ECA will be will rank it in the top continent for 2019.
Fastest growing.
And I think that's going to be driven off three things. One, the infrastructure gap that Africa has had for many a year. Second, I think, is the GDP growth across the continent of Africa. And correlated to that is the huge population growth. And I think that is going to create a market which will drive governments in across not sub-Saharan Africa, Africa as a whole, to undertake huge infrastructure spend, and will give the continent a big focus in terms of those who are in the ECA market.
Okay. Alexia, you've obviously spoken about some of the challenges that a number of African countries could have because of the oil price. But do you concur with Gabby's view that from a investment climate point of view, there could be this could be sort of attractive place for increased investment?
Yeah, we should make a distinction here between the kind of hypothetical scenario where the oil price is low, which could happen or could not, but certainly I wouldn't want to staple myself to that, versus I think the very true thing that Gabby's just said, which is that Africa has high GDP growth. I should make the distinction here. There are 54 countries in Africa. Everybody knows that, right? But when you say there's high GDP growth in Africa, well, that may be true regionally. There are, of course, variations throughout. So it might just be worth looking at. Let's stick with two African countries that I know are a big interest for investment, because I think it ties back nicely to some of the other things we've been talking about as well. If we look at Angola and Zambia, which are two countries, they have the infrastructure gap, they have the financing gap, they have the potential for growth. They're in both, particularly in Zambia, there's a certain amount of political instability going on, but nothing that, we're talking about the political instability that comes from the friction between parties as opposed to political instability where you're imminently looking at down the barrel of riots. And in Angola, where you have a certain level of political instability because you have a relatively popular government in charge. These countries are both receiving resources from China, largely, to fill the gaps that they have. As I think I mentioned the figure before, $17 billion coming to Angola from China. But what I haven't mentioned before is there's also the possibility of refinancing in that way. And just to call back to last year's prediction podcast, I think it was mentioned that One Belt, One Road, which is where this financing is coming through is an opportunity for ECA. And if that opportunity exists, this has got to be one of the key places it exists.
What, in Angola?
Not in Angola.
In Africa.
But in Africa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where China is investing.
Yeah.
Say what you want about individual countries.
Okay. I don't think, obviously I've just made my prediction for Africa, but when you look at Angola, I think Angola is going to struggle. I think that, they've had something like in the last year, 40%+ depreciation of their currency against the dollar. 95% of their revenue is oil related. They're going through the IMF position. Yes, there's going to be opportunities in oil and gas. There always will be. But outside of that, I think it's one of those markets that they're going to really struggle in 2019.
Angola is such an interesting one to watch. I just want to pick up on two points that you just raised. On the specific point of diversification, I think you're completely right. If Angola doesn't manage to do what the president is trying to do, which is diversify away from oil, which he's going to struggle with, that the currency continues to depreciate, and which I'm sure he's trying to do with the assistance of Chinese investment, you're right. Without that diversification, it doesn't look positive going forward. But I also want to pick up on the dynamic you just mentioned with the IMF. And I think that this is an interesting one that we haven't seen played out well yet, which is where there are countries that traditionally would have gotten funding from the IMF, which, let's face it, is a Western power source.
Go to China. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Because Zambia.
Yeah. Well, Zambia is the other example here. Yeah. That's exactly right. And I think that dynamic is fairly nascent. I think so far we've seen both playing in these markets. But I think if China starts to really accelerate and make a play where it's replacing the IMF, it offers much more favorable terms at this point. When it comes to their finally accommodating things like local content requirements, which is one of the big sticking points that traditionally Chinese investment has had in African markets especially, but also Latin American markets, for example, they're becoming better at accommodating those. And I think the IMF, if I could make a totally wild prediction, the IMF is slowly going to get displaced by Chinese investment.
Okay. Is that a prediction for
I shouldn't put a time limit on it. Let's say it's a prediction for this year. We're going to see signs that that's happening.
Very good.
Well, I think the sign is already there. You look at...
I've already won.
look at the official Chinese support into Africa is three times the size of the World Bank into Africa today. That's fact. So I think the looking east as Africa does now, I think, is far more important for them than looking towards the US.
I don't disagree, and I think the IMF was displaced in Africa a few years ago already, as I think China became the largest provider. But I do want to draw attention to the fact that there's a little bit of a sort of a realignment back to the West, and a lot of African countries recognize that they've had an over-reliance on China and want to rebalance that. And that's certainly true of the country we were just talking about, Angola, where they recognize they're heavy reliant on China. They conducted a roadshow through Europe at the end of 2018. The new president came, and nobody could really anticipate just how much he would change in that country as quickly as he has done. If you think about the Dos Santos regime and how he's removed that, and not just one or two family members, it is a regime change. I mean, all the people who had connections have been replaced across the country, and João Lourenço has moved remarkably quickly on all of that. His roadshow to Europe was all about reattracting European investment and European banking money too, and they have had a rapprochement with the IMF. They haven't asked for money. They've asked for a sort of a support and almost like an observation period with the IMF. And that's very, very significant because it makes international banks much more comfortable in working in that country. It lends a transparency that hasn't been there before. It makes people far more comfortable about KYC and client onboarding issues, the embarrassment of being caught on a large reputational risk issue is substantially mitigated by their rapprochement with the IMF. That's very, very helpful. And they're not the only country in Africa to do that. So I just want to, I don't think the game is over in Africa. I think it did swing to China, and I think there's actually a little bit of a swing back again.
Does it make a challenge going into African countries that have had a high level of borrowing with China? where that's not necessarily always disclosed, if you're now going into sort of some of those countries and looking to sort of maybe finance a new project, not knowing entirely the level of debt, is that proving challenging? Or could that sort of hold Gabby's prediction back?
Look, absolutely. Working in any country where not everything is on the table in terms of numbers and disclosure of debt is very, very uncomfortable. So transparency is very, very important, regardless of whether that's debt that's come from China or other places.
I agree. Yeah. And I think also, if you know, there are more countries in Africa that are needing guidance from the IMF. But I think China is very clever in terms of using that reposition in their favour. So if you are a country which has gone through an IMF program and you end up as a HIPC status country and you are under IMF concessional lending, then China are masters of being able to come in very quickly and provide the concessional finance that meets the IMF World Bank requirements of that sovereign with the IMF. They're able to provide loans which are deemed to be concessional and therefore compliant to the IMF protocols, which in my opinion reinforces China's power in Africa, because a lot of other countries, UK is a great example, is unable to provide concessional loans, is unable to provide aid with trade to end up with an export credit facility which meets the IMF concessionality. So I think that where the IMF steps in, China are waiting by the sides.
I think that's exactly right. And if I can just make one clarifying point, when I'm making a I think both of you have said, you know, China is already, in terms of borrowing, you know, it's come in after the IMF, it's displaced in Africa to some extent. The point I'm trying to make is they're moving more into refinancing, right? So it's not just about coming in and funding that gap and providing money in exchange for being able to extract resources, being able to build infrastructure that is for their own purposes. Instead, they're moving more into making those refinancing deals that would have traditionally been the territory of the IMF, and that is slightly different from where they've dominated in the past.
Mm. Kevin, can I check just a clarification on your prediction that Africa will be the fastest growing ECA market? Are we excluding Sinosure from that? Obviously, it's hard to find data.
ECA is ECA.
And China Exim Bank. So
I'm just saying that the growth, if you take 2018, whatever the figures are in 2018 in terms of ECA into Africa, 2019, they'll be greater, and then the growth in Africa will be greater as a percentage than any other continent.
How about Latin America?
By far. And the biggest one is population. The population growth in Africa is phenomenal. At the moment, 17% of the world's population is in Africa. By 2020, it'd be 25%. Right. And that population, you know, at the moment in Africa, 40,000 people per day move to a city. So the infrastructure requirements around that per day is enormous. And that, I think, is for a whole host of reasons, both political and from a security perspective. That's the market where I see the real potential for the export credit agencies to play both a business opportunity and a stroke humanitarian developmental angle to provide support.
And I think where you're assisted in this bet is the fact it is still a relatively low base, isn't it?
True.
As a percentage of the global export finance market, it's a rapidly growing one, but it's a fairly low base on which to increase. And I think you could probably pick the odd country that might grow a little bit more quickly, a particular project or a particular contract could easily see it. But as a region, I won't disagree with Gabby. I think it will show that.
But you're seeing that mainly as a Chinese-led ECA growth.
No, I'm seeing it across. Because actually, I think where the pickup will be Europe
yeah.
as well. And the reason for that is that Europe, I think, will have a different agenda to China. I think Europe will want to ensure that there's greater stability in Africa, because if there isn't, it becomes a European problem.
And we're particularly talking about North Africa there, presumably.
Yeah. But actually, yeah, but not necessarily. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa where if that politically and security-wise becomes unstable, still causes a migration problem and a problem for Europe.
But the infrastructure, ECA business that we've seen recently is mainly in sub-Saharan Africa. Yeah, it hasn't been the you know, the Algeria, Libya,
Egypt.
Morocco.
Egypt's been the biggest FDI.
I'm not talking about Egypt. Egypt.
So okay,
we're talking about migration. We're talking about migration.
Migration comes.
But I think.
Comes from sub-Saharan Africa.
Do you just mean Egypt you don't class as Africa? Or
no, I class Egypt as Africa, but I don't think there's been, to my knowledge, the same level of migration from Egypt into Europe as there has been from North Africa into Europe.
No, the most of the migration comes from the Sahara or lower through to North Africa, to Europe, you know.
Yeah.
It's Ethiopians, it's Somalians, it's Nigerians.
We should make a distinction here. There's a refugee crisis, which has got to be Libya, Algeria,
Syria.
Syria. That's separate maybe from your kind of traditional migration into Europe, which is Nigeria. It's even South Africa. It's Zimbabwe, traditionally. Yeah. You know, but those are two different. You know, there's a crisis, there's a kind of sudden influx that we've seen over the last, 2.5 years. And then there's your kind of longer-term migration that, especially if you're talking about population growth, you're suggesting, I think, that might be accelerated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I was sort of at a presentation where, I mean, certainly regarding Egypt, I think fear of an unstable regime and a knock-on refugee crisis is driving certain activity to ensure that economy stays relatively strong. And so I guess that benefits your point, Gabby, in some ways as well.
The other thing, just, you know, maybe on Africa, is that if it is one of the exciting markets in export finance. It's very rewarding to work on. It's one of the things that still gets me out of bed in the morning. You know, doing business in Africa is a very rewarding thing to do, and being part of that provision of desperately needed infrastructure is a good thing, I think. And I think we'd all like to see Africa grow as a destination market as well as just follow our clients and support our clients in that market.
I agree with you. I mean, if it wasn't for Africa, I would have retired years ago. I think it's the most rewarding place to do business.
Yeah. So final question on Africa from my side. I think we mentioned in our last podcast that actually a lot of the European-denominated transactions were African transactions last year. We also mentioned local currency. Do you expect to see any more local currency transactions in Africa in 2019 versus any previous time?
I've talked about this many times. I really believe that as practitioners in this industry, we need to be spending more time and energy finding solutions on local currency for infrastructure in Africa, where the revenues associated with that infrastructure is going to be in local currency, and you know, to invoke a FX mismatch because we keep lending in dollars or in euros, I think can create a debt which is unsustainable. The challenge is that the banks and the knowledge of ECA is in one camp, and the funding of local currency is in another camp. And unless those two come together, then the challenges of finding solutions is.
So it's an aspiration rather than a prediction.
Well, look,
the
banks who are interested in ECA assets, and I'm talking very generally, 95% of them or thereabouts are annuity junkies who will want to book assets in a very efficient manner that provides support to their clients, but are looking for asset building in an efficient manner. So therefore, they're looking for annuity income associated with that asset class. And those banks have funding in euros, they have funding in dollars, they have funding in the hard currency. They don't have funding in Nigerian Naira. They don't have it in Kwacha. They don't have it, you know, in Rand. So if they do an export credit in local currency, they don't get, you know, they spend 2 years, 3 years trying to develop the project, and then they don't end up with the asset. And so that's unless that problem is solved or those two camps are brought together, it's going to be difficult to find a solution.
Simon agreed?
Yeah, no dramatic shift. I think there might be the odd deal done, but I don't think we'll see it on an industrial scale yet.
Okay. Simon Sayer, your final prediction, if you please.
Okay. My final prediction is that there will be, it's a negative one, there'll be no thawing of the economic sanction regime imposed on Russia, or for that matter, on Iran. And I think there will be probable extensions of sanctions policy beyond those two countries. And, you know, primarily by the US, but to a lesser extent also by the EU. I think in 2018, we saw some fairly light sanctions imposed on new debt in Venezuela, which was another country to add to the sanctioned list. But Russia and Iran in particular, in the past, distant past in the case of Iran, but more recent past in the case of Russia, were very important export finance markets. And we won't see a reopening of that. And I fear there will be more sanctions imposed elsewhere, because I think the patience to conduct sort of true diplomacy around the globe is drying up. And what we're seeing in terms of trade wars and so on is going to become more prevalent, not just between the US and China. And there is a probability that we'll see sanctions imposed on other countries too, that today are not sanctioned. So quite a sad prognosis, really. But the thrust of my prediction is that no thawing on Russia or Iran.
Have you read Rebecca Harding's Weaponization of Trade?
Yes.
I think that's I agree with your prediction, and I think, you know, in her book, you know, the whole analogy of how trade is being used as an extension of enforcing your political will on another country is becoming and is now ingrained, I would say, in particularly in the US. I'm interested, though, Simon, you said about the Europe as well. As I can't think of any. I'm not saying I'm a specialist in this, but which countries? Where are there sanctions which are being invoked by Europe, which are not being invoked by the US?
Oh, okay. Which are not? I see. So I'm not aware of any. I can't think of any. But the EU does, of course, have sanctions on Russia and on Iran as well,
which follow the US
broadly. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Simon Jones, anything to comment on? Because we do still see deals in Russia, in particular.
They're limited to entities that aren't sanctioned, who have individuals who aren't sanctioned and always in euro or non-US dollar currency.
Mm. So, okay, follow-up question. If there's an acknowledgement that sanctions on Russia are likely to continue throughout 2019, which means it's a period where it's been going on for best part of 5 years now, as you mentioned before, Simon Sayer, Russia was always a big ECA market. It will continue, I guess, to have large demands for infrastructure spend and industrial upgrades. What's going to be the new normal for Russia? Where will they look to finance that? Is it going to be domestically? Is it going to be looking east? Or is it something where there's European sanctions and US sanctions continue to mean different things?
So certainly domestically, which is what they've been doing the last 4 or 5 years, and actually there's in that respect, it's a large economy with a relatively large savings base as well. So Russian banks are able to fill a gap that was being provided by the international banks.
Even in US dollar funding, in addition to ruble funding.
Even in US dollar in addition. But it's also true that there have been facilities in from China too to finance specific infrastructure. So they're looking at both things. And you have to say relatively successfully. I mean, they've found a way.
But the further away Russia gets from the US and the West, the more aligned it gets with other entities around the world.
Yes.
And parties.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Agreements and I guess with Saudi Arabia.
For example. And some countries in Africa too. Actually, we've seen Russia, you know, get closer to Uganda, for example, and certainly to Venezuela. Sanctions on Venezuela haven't really affected the market greatly. There was a little bit of export finance in Venezuela over the years. Some of the European and Asian ECAs have exposure there, which probably they're worried about right now. Just anecdotally, I met President Chavez nearly 20 years ago when he was a presidential candidate.
Just saying.
And it was in London, and I was invited to a dinner where I expected there to be, you know, a couple of hundred people, and it turned out there were 12 people at dinner, and it was Chavez at his real sort of grandstanding best, a three-hour dinner where he spoke about his marvelous plans for the country, and it was really quite impressive. I must admit I was taken in a little bit by his, you know, rhetoric. It sounded absolutely fantastic. And after dinner, I introduced myself to him and said, look, you know, great speech. Thank you very much. Really interesting. You've obviously got some fantastic plans for your country. And he leaned forward and his eyes widened and he looked at me and it sort of invaded my personal space and said, you can never imagine the plans I have for my country. And with hindsight, they were pretty prophetic words because sadly, it hasn't turned out to be the best of plans.
But coming back to the point we raised on the last podcast, how much of that is to do with the current regime in the US rather than...
It's been going on, Simon, in my opinion, prior to Trump. I remember 3 years ago, at least 3 years ago, OFAC coming in to see the BBA on the export finance side and saying, if you don't do this, this and this, fines are unlimited. If you do this, this and this, fines are unlimited. You know, and they were saying this is a very big stick. They were saying if historically we've been looking at the US banking market, we're now focusing on the European banking market.
Yeah, that's to do with Iran primarily, okay. And what I was alluding to was Simon Sayer was talking about new sanctioned countries. You know, is it because of the current regime that we're seeing the potential for new sanctions? Well, is it politically driven from the US?
Certainly politically driven, but I don't think this is something we can point the finger at Donald Trump for. The sanctions on Russia and Iran predate him, right?
Yeah.
And you know, it certainly hasn't lessened.
I'm talking about new
lessened the
countries.
Tendency for there to be further ones. You know, you might be right. It might have stepped up, but it didn't start with him. It's been going a while.
Mm. And from a US perspective, if you sit in their camp and look at it, it's very efficient. It doesn't cost them anything. It enforces their rule, and it doesn't create body bags coming back. It's like you're going to war without having the cost of war. And so part of it is wanting a regime change. I mean, I'm thinking particularly here in Iran, where the impact of sanctions for the man on the street is really painful.
And just
really painful.
You know, we were talking earlier about, you asked me about the EU. We were talking earlier about Qatar, weren't we? And there's been a blockade. You know, Qatar's neighbours have ganged up on Qatar and effectively imposed sanctions of their own. So this isn't necessarily something that comes just from the US or is driven by the US. It can be something that is very regionally specific too. And you know, it's a global tendency to let your actions do your talking rather than try to resolve things around the table.
And as sort of people that have been in trade for your careers, does this worry you in terms of this trend of putting up barriers?
For sure.
It's bad for export finance?
You know, I think we, something else we also discussed, globalization has got a very, very bad press, you know, for a number of reasons. The benefits of globalization were not shared out properly. The tremendous wealth that it created didn't reach all parts of the different societies involved. And so there's been a reaction against it, but it must be the right model. It does make sense to produce where things can be produced most efficiently and have a model which moves things around on a global scale. So I feel, sadly, you know, globalization has become the scapegoat for a lot of the political issues around the world. And we're all interested in being involved in trade and, of course, trade finance. And that, therefore, is a bad thing for our industry. Hopefully, we'll see the cycle turn a little bit. But a lot of what we've seen, you know, nationalist tendencies, protectionism, closed borders, trade tariffs, these aren't things that politicians are dreaming up just by themselves. They have popular support, too, because populations have voted in the leaders that are implementing those policies.
And if you overlay that, Simon, with the regulatory impact that the banks are having to go through, where sanctions is part, you know, sanctions and the wider perspective of PR, brand and reputation, do you be involved in this particular market with this particular exporter, et cetera, et cetera. What you end up with is a very fragmented market. You know, before the podcast, we were talking about how many banks or how many institutions are in ECAs. And I think we all agreed there was a significant greater number today than it would be that there were, say, 15 years ago.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it's a very fragmented market. So, and that causes, I think, a challenge for exporters in terms of their relationship bank, who historically may have been able to cover all of their export or trade finance business, are now, will say, well, we can do this market and this market, but we can't do that. And that causes pressure on exporters. Which is why I think, going back to Simon's prediction, where I think he's right, but for different reasons, I think the ECAs will come in for the direct lending and become more active, because that fragmentation causes problems for their exporters.
Yeah.
And I think the ECAs will become the true export credit agency and bank. I think they will politically be required to fill the gap that the banks will not be filling because of...
Like Ex-Im Bank.
Yeah.
Ironically.
Okay. On that, I think there are stomachs rumbling. I think seats squeaking, lycra drying. So I'd just like to say a thank you very much to Alexia, to Simon, Simon and Gabby, and see you all next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us there.